We're going to get started, although we don't have a quorum yet. This is the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs meeting for Wednesday, January 24th. The first item on the agenda is Minnesota Legislative Auditor James Noble, and we're going to ask him to come to the table and get started, and we'll formally call the meeting to order and pass the minutes as we get a quorum. So please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. We appreciate this opportunity to be with you this afternoon. I think any time you start talking about the way the audit function is structured in Minnesota, just a little bit of history is sometimes helpful. Back in the early 1970s, the state of Minnesota's financial operations were subject to very intense examination by a group of outside executives from both the public and private sectors. This organization that studied Minnesota's financial operations was referred to as the Loan Executive Action Program, or LEAP. They made two key recommendations, and the legislature adopted them in large part. First recommendation was that the executive branch should create a Department of Finance. Prior to 1973, the financial affairs of the state of Minnesota were really handled within the Department of Administration, and LEAP said that it was time for the state to modernize and professionalize its financial operations. The state of Minnesota's had become large and complicated and needed a Department of Finance, and the legislature passed that in 1973. LEAP also recommended that the legislature create an office of the legislative auditor, that the then Public Examiner's Office, which was the auditor of state and local government at the time, be transferred into the legislative branch. They made that recommendation because that is the model that is followed in the Congress with the General Accounting Office and around most states, that the post-audit function is thought to be a legislative oversight and accountability function. The legislature adopted that recommendation in part. Part of the Public Examiner's Office was transferred into the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the part that has audit jurisdiction over state government. But the legislature felt that the state auditor should have responsibility to audit local units of government. Prior to 1973, actually the state auditor, which had been created in the Minnesota Constitution, was not a post-audit function. The state auditor prior to 1973 was an internal controller within the executive branch. So again, 34 years ago, the Minnesota legislature created both the Department of Finance and the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And so we're here today with basically the same mission that we were given then, and that is to promote accountability, to strengthen legislative oversight, and support good financial management in the use of public funds. We have two principal goals. We have a lot of goals, but the two most important for your consideration are that we try to provide you, the legislature, the public, other public officials, with information that is accurate, objective, and timely. Governor Pawlenty often says that everybody's entitled to their opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, oftentimes there are competing facts, but we try to give you some common set of facts that are given to you from an objective, professional point of view, so you can use those to at least start the debate. Obviously, then you apply a lot of other considerations and come to your judgments. But our role is to try to give you a set of facts that you can trust as accurate and objective. But we're not just a research organization. We are an audit organization, and so we have a particular focus, and that is to find problems. We do, in fact, go into state government and try to find the weak spots and the problems. And we try to recommend workable, cost-effective solutions. So those are our two principal goals. So what kind of an organization are we over at the Office of the Legislative Auditor? And we're over, by the way, in the Centennial Building. Well, first and foremost, we are a nonpartisan office. We're a professional office. Most of our financial auditors are CPAs. Many of them are also certified information systems auditors as well. We also have a number of people in our program evaluation division with graduate training in a wide range of subjects so that they can do the kind of evaluation work that you ask us to do. And the Office of the Legislative Auditor is also an independent audit organization. This is something that's important for any audit organization to be, and that is to have a large degree of independence. And that independence can be structured in a wide range of ways. The way it's structured for us is that the Legislative Auditor is appointed by a bipartisan commission of the legislature, the Legislative Audit Commission, and is appointed for a 6-year term. And so it gives the Legislative Auditor some degree of independence to tell you things that you may not want to hear. And I know that some of you often don't agree with everything that we say, but my 6-year term prevents you from the impulse of quickly disposing of me. And if you just wait, you can change that. But then I think you'll find on the day that you don't like what I say, the next day you may find something that you do. So it tends to work out. Senator Rest, for example, who has been on the Legislative Audit Commission for many years, has been chair often. Dan McElroy was also chair, but they all had told me that they do agree with us about half the time. So we are independent. Another thing that supports our independence is that our reports are our own. When you assign us to do work or when we do audits at our own initiative or investigations, the reports that we deliver to you are the work of the professional staff. They are not reviewed in advance and approved by the legislature. In fact, the Legislative Audit Commission does not even see our reports until the day they are released. So what you get in front of you when you get one of our reports is not the position or recommendations of the Legislative Audit Commission, but of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So what work products do we produce for you? Well, there are several. First of all, we do the audit work on the state's comprehensive financial report. This is the annual report that the state is required to prepare according to generally accepted accounting principles. We do the audit work that renders an audit opinion on this annual financial report. And that's a very important part. It's not, I think, as much appreciated as it might be, because it's a very technical report. This is a report that goes to the credit rating agencies that give the state a credit rating on its bonds. They look at this very closely because this gives them an objective, accurate picture of the state's financial condition and its operations. So this is what credit rating agencies look at, and they do require that it be audited by an independent auditor. So that's an important part of what we do. But we also go to individual agencies and do compliance and control audits. We do about 35, 40 of those a year. Just to give you an example, recently, this year in July, we issued a report on the Department of Corrections. And just a typical finding that we have in that report is that in their procurement process, some employees in the department had not given adequate adherence to conflicts of interest. And so we cited in them their violation of those principles. We also told the department that they did not have legislative authority to establish a nonprofit organization, which they established. We think that is really the purview of the legislature to authorize, and so we criticized the Department of Corrections for exceeding its authority in establishing this nonprofit organization. Other types of work that we do computer security audits. This is a relatively new part of our work as computers have become much more important in the financial operations of state government. We've built a small but a very skilled group of people to do very specialized information security audits. Unfortunately, over the last several months, we've lost a number of those people. Some of you may know Chris Boozy, who was our chief auditor in our information security audit team. He really helped build that team over a number of years, but he is now the chief security officer for the Office of Enterprise Technology. And he took with him a number of other of our staff. So we went about pointing out a lot of the problems, security problems that exist in the executive branch. They hired our people to fix them. But we're happy that Chris is there. Anyway, some of you may remember one of the computer security audits that we did that involved the Department of Public Safety's web-based motor vehicle registration renewal system, the online tab renewal system. You remember that we found security problems, they shut that down, they fixed the problems, and it's back up. So we do these as well. We also do a limited number of investigations. We are not a criminal investigating agency, but from time to time, allegations come to us. In fact, we receive about 100 a year. We receive them in a variety of ways, from citizens calling us, legislators getting in touch with us. And we do have two investigators that review these allegations. And from time to time, we pursue a full-blown investigation of an issue that involves potential conflicts of interest, potential misuse of state resources. One that you may recall from 2003, there was a lot of controversy early in the legislative session that a campaign contribution to the Pawlenty for Governor campaign had influenced the Commissioner of Commerce in a settlement that he made with the American Bankers Insurance Company. It was quite a serious allegation that basically that the Commissioner of Commerce, Glenn Wilson, had acted in a corrupt way. There were a number of legislative hearings, and we were then asked to investigate. We did. We took a lot of sworn statements from people. We looked at the documents involved, and we said that we found no substantiation to the allegation that Commissioner Wilson had acted in an inappropriate way. However, a grand jury did find that the campaign contribution was an illegal campaign contribution. The company, American Bankers, and its officers were indicted, and they paid $1 million fine to settle that indictment. The other sorts of work that we do, I think you're probably even more familiar with, and that would be our program evaluations. And we do about 6 or 8 of these a year. I think you're going to hear one of them later in this meeting if we have time. But they cover a wide range of issues. Last year, for example, we looked at pesticide regulations, substance abuse. We looked at tax compliance. So these come from you. The requests to do these evaluations come from legislators. We're currently in the process of releasing reports on the topics that we got from you that were approved by the Legislative Audit Commission last year. We recently released a report on state grants to nonprofits. We released a report the other day on post-employment obligations to public employees, and one that you're going to, I think, hear later on volunteer firefighter pension plans. Tomorrow we'll be releasing a report on watershed management. The following Monday, a report on the administration of human services. And then finally, a report on prevailing wages. So those are the work products that we produce for you. So what is our jurisdiction then? And this kind of takes us back to where I started, and that is the jurisdictional division or divide that the legislature created back in 1973 between the legislative auditor and the state auditor. The basic jurisdictional difference is that the state auditor, as I said, audits local units of government, and the legislative auditor audits state government. It is a little more complicated than that, but that is the basic jurisdictional divide. So for financial audits, the legislative auditor audits every organization in the executive branch, including all the constitutional officers, all the boards and commissions, all of the departments and agencies. We also have audit jurisdiction over the judicial branch, and we do increasingly some audit work in the district courts and in the appeals courts. Our audit jurisdiction is expanded, though, somewhat just beyond organizations, because we do have jurisdiction to follow state funds. So particularly with our program evaluation work, we sometimes follow state funds into programs that are actually administered locally. Again, we're not doing financial audit work there. That is the responsibility of the state auditor. But sometimes you have issues about policy or program performance that you want us to look at, and it involves a local units of government. For example, last year we looked at the state money that goes to school districts for integration revenue, obviously administered by school districts, but a state policy with state money, so we did that evaluation. The state auditor does not currently do evaluation work. So again, we try very hard, and I think successfully over these years, not to tread on the financial audit jurisdiction of the state auditor's office. We respect that. But from time to time, as with the report you're going to talk about later with volunteer firefighters, that is the financial audit jurisdiction of the state auditor. But legislators had some broader policy considerations and concerns that they wanted the legislative auditor to look at. Now, when you get to metropolitan agencies, you can have a debate as to what are they. Are they local government or are they state governments? The legislature decided many years ago to simply arbitrarily sort of divide metropolitan agencies between the state auditor and the legislative auditor. State auditor has jurisdiction over the Metropolitan Council. The legislative auditor audits the Sports Facilities Commission, the Mosquito Control District, and the Airports Commission. We also have audit jurisdiction over a wide range of other quasi-governmental organizations that receive state funds. Our authority from you in law is quite strong, and I think it needs to be, because the work we do needs to be thorough. And so in law, you've required people whom we audit to cooperate. The law says that anybody that receives state funds, any commissioner, deputy commissioner, public employee, who is under examination by the legislative auditor must cooperate. And that occurs in almost every instance where we've done work. But in case there is the need for a little more authority than just the requirement of cooperation, we do have the subpoena authority, and we do have the authority to take testimony under oath. So finally, our basic organization is quite simple. Kind of given what you heard about the work that we do, we have a financial audit division where we have about 35 financial auditors. We have a small program evaluation division that does the work that I referred to earlier in the dark blue covers. We have 12 evaluators in that division currently. We did go through the budget cuts that we all went through. The Office of Legislative Auditor had a reduction in staff of about 20 people. We used to have 80. We currently have about 60 people altogether. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. What I'm going to ask is that members hold their questions for the Legislative Auditor until we have the State Auditor come forward, and she's going to talk about her jurisdiction, and then once you hear her report, if you have questions for either one, we'll have them both come to the table, and you can ask them both questions about which area it may fall under if you have those questions. So with that, I'm going to ask that Minnesota State Auditor Rebecca Otto please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Rebecca Otto, would you like me to spell that?
No, that's
okay. Fine.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm delighted to be here today. I actually got to serve on this committee, and I know the importance of it. And I come here today as the state auditor to basically talk about, I think the legislative auditor did an excellent job of talking about the differences between the two offices. I have a briefer presentation, and if you have questions, I would be happy to try to answer them for you. This office is real visibility, and the public typically doesn't even know it exists quite often. And what I'm trying to help people to understand is that $20 billion a year is spent by local government, $20 billion a year. So we have oversight over that money being spent, and we can we provide oversight, basically, to make sure people are following the laws and are using good, prudent fiscal management. And so it's a very, very important function. I see this office as a good government office. If we're doing our job well, hopefully we can actually get out in front of some of the problems that locals might have in terms of dealing with new accounting standards, new statutes, things like that. So we provide an educational role as well for these folks and for the public as well. We're really an accountability and transparency office, which we want government to be accountable and transparent, and so the people can get access to financial statements, to audits and different things, and make sure taxpayer dollars are being spent appropriately. let's see here. Now, we have six divisions, okay? First of all, we audit all 87 counties. We oversee them. And the three cities of the first class, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, we can, and then we have scheduled audits. We do some townships. We do many other entities. And I have a long list if you'd like to see that. But they're all audited. Some of them are audited by private CPA firms. And then we review the audits, okay? We have six divisions. Our biggest division is the audit division, and because that's our main function. We also have, and we have offices actually around the state. We have our office in St. Paul. It's at 525 Park Street, and I have had so many legislators say to me, where is your office? My GPS does not recognize my office, okay? So it's bad. But we're right across on the other side of University from Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. So. We have a government information division, which is very important and does inform your process. The government information division, we collect a lot of financial data on local government from around the state. We then take that information and we can analyze it. So we do reports for you to help inform your policy and planning and also for local government. So for instance, we put out a tax increment finance report. You may have seen that before. Letting you know about trends and things that are going on within TIF districts. Any issues, things that might need to be looked at. We do reports. There's the most requested report we put out is the municipal liquor store report. Can you believe that? I couldn't believe it. But anyways, we do report on municipal liquor stores around the state, and there are people that are very interested in that report as well in terms of how many there are, how they're doing, profitability, issues that we see. Okay, so we put out 8 to 10 reports a year. Sometimes we'll do special reports. So we have a legal and special investigations division, which is very critical as well. We not only help guide local government folks, let's say they're drafting some legislation and they might come to us and say, do you as the auditor see any issues with this legislation? And we can then check with our staff, our legal staff and audit staff and whoever else to make sure that they've got a good bill, at least from our perspective. So we can provide that service. We provide trainings. We deal with, there's a statute, 609.456, that requires that local elected officials and employees of local government, if they suspect malfeasance, misfeasance, or nonfeasance within their local government unit, that they have to report to our office. Then we have staff that looks at the complaint or allegation, and we decide if it's worth investigating. And if it is, we can go ahead and investigate that. We don't have prosecutorial abilities, so we would refer it then if there was an issue to the appropriate authority, like the county attorney, whoever that would be. We also, and then we take citizen inquiries. We have citizens who call on a daily basis and email on a daily basis asking us questions about, okay, so my school district is doing this, is that okay? They're providing donuts at a training. So we are dealing with public inquiry all the time, which I think is very important because they want clarification. And or they might have a complaint and say, I think there's criminal activity. And again, we have to look at those and respond to those. There's quite a few people that contact the office. Sometimes the audit staff will discover an issue, and then legal and special investigations division will go in and work with audit to get to the bottom of the problem. We have a pension division. We deal with 730 volunteer fire relief associations, and so we make sure that they're following the laws when implementing their pension system or their pension funds. And then we have the tax increment finance division. And again, we oversee approximately 2,200 TIF districts throughout the state, and that's an economic development tool, and we're there to make sure that they're complying with the appropriate laws. We also issue reports on that. We provide trainings for local government, again, to deal with new accounting standards, new statutes, and things like that, or reporting data to us so that they're successful, so that we have good data and they're successful with what they need to do. In closing, we're really an accountability and transparency office at the local government level, and look forward to helping to hopefully provide some meaningful reports to you to help inform your decision-making process. The legislative auditor talked about how they're nonpartisan. I want you to know that my approach is nonpartisan. I think it's really important to give any information we put out there, make sure we're providing meaningful analysis that doesn't have spin. You know, if there are different angles, we're going to try to provide those angles. And we're working on the format of the report so that they're really interesting, so that when you get one of our reports on your desk, and I know you get this much paper every day, that you really want to dig into our reports and that they're useful. So we're working on the format as well.
All right. right. Thank you. Actually, if I could have the legislative auditor come back to the table, and then I'll open it up for questions. Do members have any questions? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a comment, Auditor Otto. I'm trying very hard to unburden you from having to audit all those municipal liquor stores. All right, so I'll keep working on that for you. But, Madam Chair, Auditor Otto, the legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles, delineated a number of different units of government that he oversees and then that your office oversees. I guess the question that I have for you is that constitutionally decided that there must be this division, that your office can only audit local units of government and then defined regional units of government, or if there's enough citizen complaint, would your office ever take on auditing a state agency, for instance, which currently is under the purview of Mr. Nobles?
State Auditor, go ahead, Ms. Otto. Sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskin, that's a great question. You know, I met with the legislative auditor and we discussed our jurisdictions, and really what we're charged with in the Constitution is local government. And that's the way it is. People are very interested in state agencies, but really that is her, the legislative auditor's jurisdiction. He did do a report on the relief, the Firefighter Relief Associations, because he was guided by the folks that tell them which reports to do. They wanted him to look at some bigger issues around that, but we pretty much audit them and keep track of them. So I think our lines are pretty clear. I don't know if it's appropriate that he respond as well. Does that answer your question, Representative Biskins?
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Auditor Otto, yes, absolutely. And I guess then to Mr. Noble, first, I'd like to know, how long have you been in this position, Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Nobles.
Chair, Representative Biskin, I'm appointed for a six-year term. I'm in the end of my fourth term, so I've been legislative auditor going on 24 years.
Okay.
Wow. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I like that answer because that spans, the partisan aisle your work has been under, and so I guess my question to you is, have you experienced partisanship that enters into the offices, and maybe you're asked for partisan reasons to audit something that belongs rightfully in the state auditor? Does that happen, and how do you address that and deal with it?
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, and members, it's an excellent question. And I will go back to what I said earlier. I think the legislature was very wise when it established the Office of the Legislative Auditor to give the legislative auditor independence from the partisan pressures that might come to bear. As I said, the legislative auditor serves a six-year term. I serve on appointment from a bipartisan commission. And I served under Republican chairs, Democrats, CFL chairs, two of the most active members of the commission during my time, with Dan McElroy as chair and Senator Rest. And I must say, I've never felt any pressure from them for any sort of partisan work. In fact, I think that what they expect is just the reverse. I think they would be very disappointed in our office if they felt that we were doing anything for any partisan purpose whatsoever. And I take this nonpartisanship very seriously. We do have independence requirements for our staff, and I pose them on myself as well. And so I really divorce myself from any sort of political activity. I always have for my entire career. But when it comes to requests to do work, yes, there are times when clearly there is a partisan atmosphere to some of the work we're asked to do. I would go back to the example I cited with the investigation we did relative to the Commissioner of Commerce. That was a very, very partisan environment in which we were asked to do that investigation. But I think the legislature turned to the legislative auditor because you had confidence that we would do that work in a totally nonpartisan way. And we had under investigation not only the Commissioner of Commerce, and in fact we took a sworn statement from the governor and many other people involved, but we also took under investigation the involvement of the Attorney General at the time, Mike Pence, and his involvement with that settlement. And so again, you're talking about high visibility political officials in this state with a very serious allegation being leveled against the governor and his appointee, the Commissioner of Commerce, that because of a campaign contribution, the Commissioner of Commerce acted in a corrupt way. And I think our conclusions were accepted as objective and factual because we have built credibility over the years that we are nonpartisan. So I hope that gives you some flavor of how I feel about it.
Actually, Representative Biskins, I'm going to actually formally call this meeting to order just so we have it for the minutes here. So do you have one more follow-up, Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, one more follow-up, and I appreciate that very much, Mr. Nobles, and I found that the work you do to be very nonpartisan also. All right? But my question really is looking at the other side. You're a nonpartisan office, all right? But the office that you work side by side with and you know sometimes communicate with is a very partisan office. The reason I appreciate that you spanned many different chairs, partisan chairs, and many different state auditors, partisan state auditors, is the reason for my question. Have you ever felt that your compadres in the state auditor's office have attempted to interject partisanship in the work that you do?
Madam Chair and Mr. Representative Biskin, members, the answer to that, obviously, with the new state auditor here is very important. And I have not had a great deal of time to work with her, but I have worked over the years with Arnie Carlson, Mark Dayton, Judy Dutcher, and Pat Anderson. So I've spanned a number of state auditors, and I must say that I think all of them worked very hard to take as much partisanship out of the process as possible. I think you have to understand, and certainly the current state auditor can elaborate on this, they have professionals, they have CPAs doing the same work that we do to the same audit standards. There are national audit standards. And I've seen every one of these state auditors adhere to those standards and work diligently, knowing the responsibilities of the job to do work that was not only in fact, but which would be perceived to be completely nonpartisan. I would only add that because it is an elected office with a partisan party endorsement, that they do carry probably more of a burden than I do to work at this, and there will always be those who use the partisan nature of the office against them to say that there is a partisan motivation. When from my perspective, I look at their work and I don't see it. In fact, we investigated, and some of you may have been around at the time, but speaking of a work we were asked to do that was brought to us in a very partisan environment, we were asked to investigate the work of State Auditor Arnie Carlson after he became governor. There were allegations published in the Star Tribune that as state auditor, Arnie Carlson had given favorable treatment to a former colleague of his, John Chenoweth. And at the time, Mr. Chenoweth was the executive director of a Minneapolis pension plan, which was subject to audit by the state auditor. These allegations were quite serious, and we investigated. We were asked to investigate. So again, we took sworn statements, we looked at the documents, and our conclusion was that as state auditor, Arnie Carlson did not influence in any inappropriate way the audit work of the Minneapolis pension plan. And yet, because of his political visibility, he was subject to a lot of criticism and suspicion, which I think was unfair and unwarranted.
All right. I have a list now here. Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, Ms. Otto, do either of you monitor and evaluate the Job Z program?
Representative
Madam
Ms.
Chair.
Ms. Otto, sorry.
You can call me Madam Auditor. No.
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair, representatives, members, and Representative Schumper. Job Z actually, last legislative session, we were given statutory authority to oversee Job Z zones. There was an issue with the funding, and so we're going to be coming back this legislative session with an initiative asking for the appropriate funding so that we can actually provide some oversight, because currently there is no oversight. Well, we've been given the oversight, but we don't have the funding to do it, so.
Good, good.
I just will clarify that the funding that was made available was tax increment financing, which is not legally allowed to use TIF to audit Job Z. So it will be coming back before us because there is a legal problem with using TIF money to audit Job Z. So next on the list is Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this question is for Auditor Nobles. I just want to say that your reports are really appreciated for those of us in legislative office, because I look at these reports. I mean, I know I do keep a stack of them, but I do look at them. And regarding this newest one, which we'll talk about later, the pension for the volunteer firefighters, I was wondering if there's a reason that you didn't list the pensions in detail of all the other, of all the relief associations. For instance, you do list a median benefit and an average benefit, and is there a reason there isn't a table that defines all the different benefits, which would be, and maybe it's here and noted and I couldn't find it, but it would be, I would think, of interest to the local elected officials who also serve on those pension relief association boards.
Madam Chair, members, you know, we struggle with this a lot, how much detail to put in our reports. Over the years, frankly, we've tried to slim down our reports. We recognize you're very busy. You get a lot of paper. So we do plead guilty to condensing things, but we do have a lot of backup detail that we can provide. We have been providing some legislators with the answer to exactly that question, and I'd be happy to get it for you or any of the other members. We also, from time to time, we'll include an appendix with more detailed information. Again, it's a judgment about how much interest there will be. There is always a certain cost to adding to the report. So we've also been using our website to try and post more detailed information. And if you feel that that would be helpful to a number of people, we'd be happy to try to get that up on our website or even, if need be, publish it as a paper document as well, because we do have that detail.
I would think, thank you, Ms. Chair, Auditor Nobles. I would think that on your website that would be very beneficial to the local units of government who have their elected officials serve on those boards. And so if you have that, I would like to see it. Or in the future, if it's on your website, that would be of interest to a lot of people, I would think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Nobles. In your reports, you usually have your list of recommendations, and they're usually pretty concise. I'm wondering if you've ever given the legislature a report card and going through your reports and keeping track of what percentage of the recommendations are implemented in full or part.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Holbrook, a good question, one I appreciate, because soon, just in a few weeks, we'll be issuing some report cards on implementation of our recommendations on some of our past evaluation reports. And we try to do that every year, and we'll be having that for you. Because we do want impact. We don't want to just do this work and have it put on the shelf. We don't lobby. One of the limitations I think we have in terms of having impact is that we lay out our recommendations, and then we let you, other staff, and the various interest groups go at it, so to speak. And we don't walk the halls. We don't come back to your offices saying, you know, where are you on that recommendation and are you behind us? We just don't think that's an appropriate role for us. So we have that limitation, but we still want impact. And so we certainly appreciate it when legislators pick up on our recommendations. And some of our recommendations, as you well know, do relate to legislative action, although a lot of them are to the agency for implementation. So we periodically ask commissioners to tell us, where are you in terms of implementing our recommendations? For our financial audits, actually, the governor, and this, again, spans many administrations, the governor has always tasked the commissioner of finance to keep a running tally on a quarterly basis of implementation of all of our financial audit recommendations. So that's also available. And the scorecard there is quite good. We have 95% implementation quite quickly of our financial audit division recommendations. But they are much more kind of cut and dried. They're much more about financial controls and that sort of thing, and much more easily implemented than sometimes the more sensitive policy and programmatic recommendations that we make to the legislature. So sometimes it takes a little longer to get implementation from the legislature.
Just for clarification purposes, you do it on kind of a hit-or-miss basis. You don't do it on any running counts or...
For our, Madam Chair...
Mr. Noble.
For our program evaluation, we try to do it at least annually. We try to go back for all of the reports that we issued the previous year. For example, we issued a report last year on pesticide regulation. And so a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, we asked the Commissioner of Agriculture to go through each one of our recommendations that we made to the department and tell us where you are. Now, what we don't have the resources to do, usually, is to go back in and independently verify. On an ad hoc basis, we do that. Just this week, for example, we are beginning a follow-up evaluation of implementation of our recommendations on the MnCARE report that we did some years ago. So we asked the department, where are you in terms of implementing our recommendations? But we're also going to ask them to document that, not just tell us, but show us, so we can verify.
All right. Further questions? If not, thank you very much, both of you, for coming, and hopefully we will see you again in the future.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. When do you want our presentation of the volunteer firefighter? Because the reason I ask, and I think you know this, is that the staff person who is going to make that presentation is currently making that presentation in the Senate.
Right.
And will be here soon. So you have other business to attend?
Yes, we're actually going to take up a bill for that very reason. We know that they're presenting in the Senate, and if they get here on time, they'll be making the presentation today. And if not, we understand that they may have gotten hung up over there. So, thank you. Ms. Otto, did you have a comment?
You know, one thing I didn't do, I think I should probably do, just for members that may not be familiar. For the units that we audit, we can always go in at any time and audit a local unit of government if we think it's in the public's best interest, just so you know. We have regular audits of certain ones, and then other ones we have on a rotational basis where our office goes in. But we can do townships, cities, sometimes school districts. Really, the Department of Education, just to clarify, does more oversight over school districts, but we can assist them. And we can also go in and audit if need be. The counties, police and fire relief associations, housing and redevelopment authorities, port authorities, soil and water conservation districts, and then approximately 150 special districts, just for clarification for anyone who might be concerned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Yaros, are you here? Please come to the table and this bill needs to go to Governmental Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. So I would entertain a motion to move the bill. Representative Lincheski moves House File 119 be recommended to pass and sent to Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. Representative Yaros, go ahead.
I suppose you have time to hear it. Otherwise, I would just... probably would just send it there.
Go ahead, Representative.
Madam Chair, lady, and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to hear this bill. I been thinking about this for quite a while. In fact, one of my predecessors introduced similar legislation 20, 30 years ago. I introduced it, I think, about 4 years ago, and the committee didn't have enough time, as you know. I believe you were, Madam Chair, you were on this committee previously, so you know how busy this committee gets, how many bills you get. In fact, when I got here, this committee consisted, was divided into three committees: city government, county, and metropolitan affairs. Three committees. So I know it's a busy committee, and I wanted to get on the committee, but I had a conflict, and I've never served on this committee. I hope to someday, because it's okay. Madam Chair and members, what this is a study, the study commission would consist of legislators, county commissioners, city councilors, township officials, school board members, business and labor representatives. And the commission would study during the interim establishment of municipal government called South St. Louis Municipality. As you know, there are such municipalities, such governments. Milwaukee is one of them, and I believe Dade County, Miami is another one. The commission would determine if the creation of the municipality would eliminate duplication of services such as public works, law enforcement, fire protection, and education to reduce administrative and duplicative costs. Of course, that's my aim. My aim is not to annex anybody or take over anything. It's just I think makes sense not only in South St. Louis County but all over the state. I think we should the local units of government and state should work on trying to eliminate duplications and provide efficient service and reduce costs. If the St. Louis County municipality is established, the names of cities, townships, schools will remain the same. The South St. Louis County municipality would be within the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District boundaries. That is Duluth, Hermantown, Proctor, in about, I believe, 20 townships. And I'm sorry, I forgot, Madam Chair, on page 1, line 1.22, I would like to strike period and insert comma and put in three words, excluding Carlton County, or except Carlton County. I forgot that part of Carlton County is within the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, and it's not my intention to get into their county.
Representative Lincheski, would you like to incorporate that into your motion? Okay. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So, we will not be asking for, I'm not asking for any money from the state. The cost of the expenses would be borne by boards, councils, and the legislature. You know, legislators, there would be only two legislators, and they would have to figure out how to fund this. Probably not, I'm sure that, we will not. If I'm on the commission, I'm not going to ask for any money. Staff would be the Arrowhead Regional Development Commission. They're really familiar with local governments, and if this passes, I would be discussing this with them to see. The report will not be large. I don't think it's going to be expensive. As Legislative Auditor Noble said, we have so much reading to do, we don't need another report. It will be simple, and if this is successful, it will come before the governor and the legislature by February 1st of 2008.
Representative Yaros, is there any opposition that you know of to this?
Well, a couple of people have talked to me, asked me, and League of Municipalities. I think they're here if they have. I don't think they were going to they may comment, I don't know if they're taking, I don't think they're opposing it, because this is just a study. If there is a problem, it's not gonna happen. So we would iron those out locally in South Lake, St. Louis County.
Okay, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yaros, I'm trying to get my hands around this municipality that you describe here, the feasibility of establishing such. How do you envision this municipality? It doesn't sound like it's replacing any other. Is it fundamentally going to work hand in hand with St. Louis County, or would this entity be completely under St. Louis County, or would this entity is it acting like a county at all? I guess I'm trying to get my head around what's being asked for here.
Representative Yarn.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Biscuits. Well, I don't know for sure the study would determine, but my idea would be, yes, to establish, if you will, a municipality which would be like 88 County. And there would be representatives from each city and township on that joint council or board, and they would be working as a municipality to, again, reduce duplication of services and reduce administrative costs.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Yaros. I have a brochure here, and I'll get it in bigger print. I pulled it off the web, and it's kind of little print. But it's an association called SCALE, and it's Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency, and it's all the municipalities within Scott County, including the townships and the cities and the school boards, and even the tribal government came together, and they said, let's come together and let's look at the services we provide the cities within this county, taking the leadership by the county itself, and they do some excellent work, and in fact have been cited in a couple of awards for the work they do on looking for efficiencies. And so I guess, you know, here's an example of a county that didn't need a governmental study, right, to do what is basically the right thing. And I know, sitting next to my colleague on the right here, Representative Holberg can attest that both Scott County and Dakota County have worked together on a number of projects, most notably County Road 42, right by the Burnsville Center there, where it really gets to be a mess. Again, we didn't need a governmental commission to study this. They just got together and said, you know, we're bright. And I know those people up in Duluth area are bright people themselves. So I guess I'm questioning the need for a study to come together to look for efficiencies. But, Madam Chair, I do have a question of staff, and that is the word municipality. Does the word municipality in statute come with inherent rights, including zoning rights, including taxation provisions, all of, you know, what we consider municipalities having the powers to do? Would this entity, by having that word municipality, have those prerogatives?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, within the context of this bill, no, because the bill is using the term without definition. Municipality is defined so many different ways in statute, so it depends where in statute you are and how you define it. For example, the tort liability statute defines municipality to include pretty much every kind of entity out there. But in the annexation statute, municipality is clearly just cities. So it's going to depend on the context that is ultimately developed into recommendations by the study commission, what municipality means, what powers it would have, whether or not it should be created at all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, Representative Giles, my question was exactly the same as Representative Biskin's. I always think of a municipality to be a city of some kind, and so would its powers supersede the townships? I'm a township resident, and you indicated you had quite a few townships. And does it include the entire Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, is that the land base, the same as that district?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumer. Western Lake Sanitary District, yes, except that part which is in Carlton County.
Right.
I forgot that it extended to all the way to Cloquet. I don't think it's entire Carlton County, but, it would be about, Duluth, Germantown, Proctor, and about, I think about 20 townships. Is it about 20 townships? Oh, I spoke with Mr. Township here from St. Louis County.
All right, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yaros, I'm looking at your first paragraph A under Section 1. The study commission's 15 members, and it talks about who they're going to be. There's St. Louis County Board, Proctor, Hermantown, Duluth, all these official entities that have governing boards that have election certificates and processes, I'm sure, for making sure folks get appointed. But the one that caught my fancy or my attention is the one on the one line 1.8, the Duluth and Iron Range Legislative Delegation. I'm looking in the statute book for what defines that, and I'm just curious. My imagination, of course, all of our imaginations run wild since we know Iron Rangers. As to who they are, how do they govern themselves, how will these decisions be made, will it be the last two standing that get to serve on the committee, so on and so forth. Madam Chair, tongue firmly in cheek, of course, if Representative Yaros wishes to respond, I think we could have some fun with it.
Well, there will be outnumbered. There will be one legislator and one probably county commissioner from the Iron Range.
All right. Next, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Yaros, I have two questions for you. In your comments, you stated that you didn't think there would be legislative expense, and so I'm wondering if you would consider it a friendly amendment on page 1, lines 23 and 24 to change the language to delete the reference to expenses being borne by the legislature, number one. And number two, what prohibits you from doing this now?
Representative Yaros.
Well, Ms. Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, first, the expenses. What I meant was legislators. There would be two legislators, and I don't know if they would get their per diems or whatever. I don't know if there would be a way, but if I am on this commission, I'm not going to ask for it. But I suppose it would be difficult to get per diem unless someone from this committee, local government or governmental operation, was on it. I don't think there will be. So we won't get paid. If the county board, school boards, and municipalities, cities and townships wish to give themselves per diem, that's fine. I don't think legislators would get. So I have no problem with that if you want it. Secondly, why... Well, they haven't done it, as far as I know. We've tried to do this several years ago, and it didn't go any place. I just think it's a good idea. I'm a liberal, but I believe in fiscal responsibility, and I am careful about my money the same as government money. For example, last time I went to NCSL convention, I didn't want to pay $175 to stay in a room. I went and found a motel for $49, and I saved the state $700. Anyway, I'm glad about that. I do the same thing for myself. Why shouldn't I? Anyway, I think that this would sort of make us get together and look at how we could do what your counties did, Scott and I think that's super, and I think we should look at it and see what can be done to eliminate duplication. For example, City of Duluth has both sheriff and police department. We don't need both. We have county and city plows, snow plows running through the city. I mean, that's,
Madam Chair, I recognize that, but there's that adage of you can lead a horse to water and you can't make him drink. And if you technically don't need this legislation to put this commission together, then if your region wants to do this, they can do this. And if they, they can do it on their own. Just because we pass a law here in St. Paul saying you'll do this. If their hearts aren't in it, they can trudge through the process as dictated by the legislature in St. Paul for what, quite frankly, is a very local matter, and you're not going to have any fruition from it because they're not... I mean, I just don't understand the need for the legislation.
Well,
if the region wants to do it, they can do it. If they want to set up some kind of unique governing structure, they can come back next year if they need legislative authority to provide for a unique or innovative structure that they come up with through this process. But to... I don't understand the need to keep printing this bill all over, you know, over and over again and go through a floor thing and pass a law and put it in the books if they can do it anyway.
Well,
I like to save money Representative Yarrow.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and Representative Holbert. Actually, you probably don't realize that there's a big, there's a movement in St. Louis County, which is huge. It's larger than Rhode Island. A lot of people that want to split the county. And I, rather than splitting it geographically in the middle, I thought it would make more sense, if it comes to that, to have metro government and county, the Iron County. Representative Rukavina wants to call it the Iron Range County. So we should look at it and see if it make, you know, if it, that's another issue. If it makes sense, I would rather do it this way. As some other municipalities have done it, like Milwaukee, rather than splitting it in Cotton, which is halfway geographically from Duluth to the Iron Range.
And one more closing comment. I think you can do this without legislation, and I think it's more effective if it's done without legislation. And having spent a lot of time in the summers in Pine County and Mr. Knisley sitting across the table here, experienced to a much larger degree the Pine County, let's split the county fight and all of that, and we actually changed legislation down here somewhere in that process. So there is at least recent statutory changes to splitting a county that provide for a process that it's at least more effective than what was in place previous to that, but good luck.
Madam Chair, would you come and help me to get the people together?
Representative Yarrows, I found it actually quite entertaining as a summer resident to read the local papers and the editorials day after day and the comments from the county commissioners and watch the whole process unfold. But to be in the middle of it, I can't imagine would be a whole lot of fun for any elected official.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yarrows, I've got a couple of questions. The first is, do you have resolutions of support or requests from the units of government that are affected by this, that they are asking the state to do this?
Madam Chair,
Representative
Lanning, no, I don't. Because there's many governmental units involved, including school boards. What I'm doing is I'm asking. I'm not imposing anything on them. If I came in with a bill that said that we shall put all those units of government and school boards together, then I would, you know, think that they should have something to say. This is an opportunity for them to say whatever they feel should be done, and if we agree, we'll bring it here. If we don't, it will stay in St. Louis County.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we don't have resolutions that they're asking for it, in effect the state is telling them you shall do this. And I guess I have a problem with that. If you look on lines 15 through 18, I very much agree with your goal here of trying to determine if there's a way in which services can be avoiding duplication and cooperative things that units of government might do together. But what scares me about line 15 and 16 is establishing a municipal government. I realize under statute that municipality has different meanings in different areas of statute, But to me, I read this as the state is telling, by passing this, the state would be telling the folks back there that you ought to look at forming some kind of super city or separate county or whatever the case might be. And for us to do that without the local folks asking us to do that, I think is dangerous. And, you know, if you want to achieve what lines 16 through 18 have, I'd suggest you take a look at what we've done out in west central Minnesota. We've got a 9-county area cooperative, including cities, counties, townships, where they've come together on their own to look at ways in which they can avoid duplication, where they can share equipment instead of two cities, two counties buying a road grader. Maybe they buy one together and avoid a lot of... And that's been working marvelously well, and there's no state authority to do that. They took that initiative on their own. And so anyway, you may want to respond.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, while, you know, I think we're kind of important, they might do when we do some, when we invite them. And if sentence line 15 and 16, the sentence there, is sort of a subjunctive clause. I should have perhaps used a different verb to make it wishful. Feasibility, I thought, would maybe feasibility is not the right word. But we will study the feasibility. It's a subjunctive mood. We will study it. It's wishful thinking. It's nothing definite.
All right. Are you finished, Representative Lanning?
But it still is telling them, the state's telling them, you shall do this, and you shall study it. And that's what I have a problem with, without any resolution of support from all the people who that would be affected by this.
Representative Lencheski.
Madam Chair, Representative Yaros, I think the word municipal, a couple, Representative Schomper and Representative Biskins raised that, and it seems like you could wordsmith, you could fix that.
Yeah.
Will this, I know I've talked to people over the years from the Duluth area and from the north, the area surrounding them, about this whole managing the wastewater and how we're going to get together on that, and it seems like that's an ongoing problem that has not been resolved. So I like your bill because I think it would, if it proceeds, would get that problem resolved. And that problem ends up in the tax committee a lot, and no one just figured out how to do it. So I actually read your bill and thought maybe that would provide for some assistance in that area. Is that the kind of problems you would envision if this study found that there might be some organization who'd look at these issues together? Is that the kind of problems they would work on? I mean, I read the line, the text of what you have there. Would that be undertaken?
And then
Representative
Yarrow. Well, that's one of the problems that could, you know, be resolved and be smoother. Of course, there are others.
All right. Representative Holberg, I believe, has an amendment.
Ms. Dyson has language to clarify that there would be no legislative expense on this.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment would be page 1, delete line 23, and then page 1, line 24, before the word staff, delete everything before the word staff, and then insert the non-legislative members' meeting expenses must be paid by their respective appointing authorities. And I'll write that up further.
That'd be great. Does anyone need clarification on that? All right. Representative Holberg moved that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. All right. With that, any further questions? Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Representative Yarrows, would you be agreeable to amending this? Because I have the same concerns that I've heard around the table in that we've got several governmental units here involved, and there's a lot of shells in the wording, which means they have to do it. Would you be agreeable to where this would not be applicable until resolutions were received from all of the jurisdictions that would be impacted by this study?
Representative Yaros.
Madam Chair, Representative Markford, no, I mean, because it's not going to happen. I suppose, you know.
Representative Markford?
We're not, Madam Chair, Representative Markford, we're not forcing him to do anything. We just want to get together. And since state created local government, I think we have a precedent to do certain things. As long, I wouldn't shove it on them. I wouldn't pass legislation and say, hey, you have to do this. I want to go and work with them. And if we can work it out, fine. If we can't, then nothing will happen.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yaros, I really like the concept. I really do. I mean, I think any time you can bring units of government like Representative Lanning had mentioned and you work and reduce duplication, I think that's great. And I think the concept here is very, very good. But, you know, but it doesn't sound like it's something that once it begins that people would have much of a choice. It's once we pass this, it says the commission shall be composed and they shall study. So it almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, let's say the city of Hermantown didn't want to become a member. It sounds like, according to this, they have to. They shall appoint. So, it's almost like the chicken or the egg here. And as Representative Holberg mentioned, if you can't, you know, if you're going to have to force this on them in the first place, it's doomed from the start. And I just think this, your bill would be, and the study would be much more effective if there was a little more original outreach and you could get resolutions from the various units of government, because you'd be going out and whoever would be talking, here's the concept, let's get involved and so forth. I really think we could be wasting our time in doing this when in reality nothing would happen unless you've got kind of a buy-in originally.
Mm-hmm. Representative Yaros.
Madam Chair, Representative Markord, if they wanted to do this, you know, if they were, you know how you've been the local government, you've been the mayor and whatever else, and the Representative Lanning and others. And, you know, there's a lot of things that could be done all over the state and all over the country, all over the world, to make the government more efficient and so on. And human beings are human beings. We're all human beings. Even we politicians are human beings. And we like to stick to our cities, townships, counties, and so on. And we don't like to look outside. This would get in Hermantown only has to appoint one person, you know, one city councilor. I would like to see this done. It was tried several years back, and I've been thinking about this. And you know, if you know, I don't think it's too much to ask. They have a lot of people on the city council. In Duluth, it's 9 people. In Hermantown has 5 or 7 councilors, and you know, it's not going to. There won't be that many meetings if they decide all those members of the commission decide that it shouldn't be done. It won't be done. Nothing. I don't want to impose anything on any unit of government. It's just looking at it for the good of our neighborhood, our municipality, our area or whatever.
One final question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Yaros, would there be a point where, let's say this goes through and let's say a few towns and that said, we don't want to participate in the study, would there be a certain point or a threshold of members you would need here before you just say, okay, we can't really even go ahead with the study? Or, what if you don't get into it?
Madam Chair and Representative Marco, I think they would. I think people would, you know, because people are interested. I'm quite sure, but, you know, that's why I want the legislation. Otherwise, it would be difficult.
All right, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Markort, you bring up an excellent point. You look at the process we are creating and the path we are going down. I it can't import members of this committee to think about this any harder. Right? We're asking that a study be developed with 15 members. Now, if my math is correct, and I spent a few years teaching this, right, that means 8 of those 15 have to agree with whatever the study says, and then it comes forward to us, the legislature. So Representative Marcourt, you're absolutely correct. Hermantown could want absolutely nothing to do with this. And yet, we created a study commission that comes forward with a recommendation. Right? That's going to carry a lot of weight down here. And it's going to impose upon a local unit of government something they may not want at all, simply because of the process we're going to allow to begin right here, or we put the kibosh to right here. Right? I think, Representative Yaros, that Representative Lanning was very thoughtful in his recommendation. Right? If there were resolutions by those who are being affected to go ahead and put this mechanism in place, then we can see, all right, no, they want us to, what the heck, we'll let them have what they want. I'd be all for it if the resolutions were there. Representative Holberg was absolutely correct. We can create this study commission, right, and if people don't want to play, all right, then it's big government coming down saying, you're going to study this, because those are the words here. It's not, well, if they don't want to do it, it won't happen. No, the words say that by law, they have to do it, all right? And so, you know, the language that we're putting in here, I think, Representative Yaros, is not only the state meddling into what should be local politics, but really is a dangerous process that 3 or 4 years down the road, all right, local units of government are really going to rue because of what we might do right here in this first step.
I really think that this could probably be cleared up with a local approval clause of some sort. And are you willing to consider a local approval clause? This has a number of places that it's going to need to go between now and there, and now and the time that it makes it to the floor. And if you'll consider some form of a local approval clause, I think it would go a long way to make this committee feel comfortable.
Well, Madam Chair and members, well, the local people will have to approve before this goes anyplace anyway. We're not, I think it would be true if I had a bill here imposing this municipal type of government. I'm not imposing it. I'm just want to look at it and study it, and if the local people want it, people from Hermantown I taught there are nice, plus they need the, they get water from Duluth. They don't cooperate, we'll shut up. No. 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 No, I think that people will cooperate. But, you know, I mean, so I'm not imposing anything. It's just asking them to sit down and discuss whether this is a good idea or not. That's it.
Okay, well, we're going to have one more question because we do have the legislative auditor here that does want to get to the volunteer firefighters. And
yeah.
So we're going to go to Representative Scalzi to finish this up.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Yaros. I can understand what you're getting at. You're trying to provide some structure for a commission to really save some money for your area. And when I sat on the city council, if I saw something like this, this would be frightening to me that the state would say shall anything. Would you be amenable to changing the shall and the would to may? And that would still give you the structure, but if Hermantown didn't want to join, they didn't have to join. And your report would show that? Because your first sentence says a study commission of 15 members. It could say up to 15 members. But I think there's 8 shells in there and 1 would. And if they were changed to may, it would provide you your structure and yet not have the heavy arm of the state coming down on some governmental unit that didn't want to participate.
Well, I don't know, Madam Chair and members. If that, you know, I don't know. I don't think that I'm forcing anything, but if that's what you want to do, that's fine. Would I still be able to? Probably, if that happened, then we wouldn't need the bill would be lame. It wouldn't accomplish anything with it.
Representative Yaros, actually, if you just change it in the first line, the study commission, a study commission of up to 15 members is created, the commission may be composed of, and it gives the composition, all the rest of the shells would still exist. It's just each of those places would have the opportunity.
Okay.
So so if you're amenable to that, was that your intent, Representative Scalzi?
Actually, I thought all the shells should be changed to me, because the shell on line 15 says the commission shall study the feasibility. But that sounds like the state is requiring that they study the feasibility, and we're not. I mean, it wouldn't be my intent to require that they study the feasibility. That's why I thought all the shells should be me, and then that would satisfy my problems with it. But I'm only one member of the committee here.
Well, members, we are now in a dilemma, because we do need to take public testimony before we pass the bill. And we do have the late of auditor here. So I'm going to ask members if they're willing to stay a few minutes beyond the end of our committee so that we can wrap this up, because I don't want to table this bill to bring it up at a later date. I'd like us pass this bill on its way and have the author be willing to work on this issue to make certain that you've heard the concerns of these members of imposing this against the will of the local units of government. That is not the intent of this body, but we understand that you need strong language in order to get people to the table to do that.
Well,
so,
then, Madam Chair, do you want to then do this amendment the way you propose? Do you think that would take care of it? And
Representative Solberg.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I was not here for all the discussion, but it seems to me, as I look at this, picking up on the conversation, that it, with your suggestion on 1.7, to change it to me, that allows that a community or a group to opt in or out. If they don't want to participate, they don't have to participate, instead of that they shall. But by keeping the shall in line 1.15 indicates what, if they do opt in, this is what they shall study. Otherwise, they may be studying all kinds of other stuff. So I think that gives the flexibility that's needed on that particular. And if you need to, I would move that we do on 1.7 the shall to a may.
All right. Representative Solberg changes line 1.7, the word from shall to may.
And then I guess, Madam Chair, to correct that, would be up to 15, so in case some community did not participate.
Do members have that?
Can I incorporate that in my amendment?
Yes, you can incorporate that into the First Amendment. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail. All right. With that, I'm Representative Yaros. I'm actually going to see if there's anyone in the audience that wanted to testify for or against this bill. Seeing none, members, I'm going to call the question. Representative Lincheski does move that House File 119 be recommended to pass and be moved to Governmental Operations. I want to make sure I get the name of the committee exactly right. Governmental Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'm going to call to the table Joe Voss from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. She's going to go over the Volunteer Firefighters Pension Presentation. We are running short on time. I do apologize for that, but I think it's important that members hear what you have to say. So please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I'm here today to briefly discuss our report on Volunteer Firefighter Pension Plan. As many of you might know, Minnesota uses a decentralized system to administer pension plans for volunteer firefighters. And we look basically at how well that decentralized system is working. Our main message is that we don't think that we need to completely overhaul the entire system. There are some, if not most, elements of local control that we think are working and should be retained. However, we are concerned about the overall low rates of return that firefighter pension funds have earned over the last several years. And let me just sort of back up now and explain a little bit about how we reached those conclusions. First of all, a decentralized pension system does present some challenges. There are over 700 different pension plans that cover about 20,000 volunteer firefighters across the state. And each pension plan is administered by a nonprofit corporation known as a Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association. And so we have over 700 relief associations, each one responsible for determining eligibility, for determining pension benefit levels, for paying pensions, and for investing pension funds for their own plans. And they do this within some broad parameters set forth in statute. Now, revenue for firefighter pensions comes from three primary sources: investment income, state fire aid, and local government contributions, some mandatory and some voluntary. In 2004, investment income made up the largest share of revenue for firefighter pensions. 45% came from investment income. Now, this can vary from year to year depending on the condition of the stock market, how well it performs, and also depending upon the types of investments pension funds have made. Relief associations closed out 2004 with $357 million in assets. Let me talk a little bit about the type of benefits that retired firefighters receive. There's a lot of variation throughout the state. Most plans make one big payment to a firefighter when that person retires. Plans usually require that firefighters put in 20 years of service before they are eligible to receive a full pension. In 2004, median benefit for a retiring firefighter, the median benefit was $16,000. That is, at the time the firefighter retired, they got a check. One check, $16,000, and then that's all they get for the rest of their retirement. But depending upon where that retired firefighter lives, that check could range from anywhere from as little as $500 up to $140,000. Now, this is a lot of variation, but we don't think the variation is totally unreasonable. We found strong positive relationships between benefit levels, the amount of state aid a relief association receives, and the number of fire-related calls that a fire department goes on. In other words, relief associations that receive more aid generally pay higher benefits, but the fire departments also make more fire-related calls in any given year. We looked at the overall health of the pension plan for firefighters and found that most of them had adequate resources to meet their needs. We looked basically at their funding ratios, which measure assets as a percentage of liabilities. A funding ratio of 100% means that a pension plan has just enough funds to cover their anticipated expenses. We found that in 2004, the median funding ratio was 106%. 65% of the relief associations had ratios of 100% or more, and 16% had ratios below 90%. We also looked at administrative spending for the pension plan, and administrative spending includes items such as board salaries, meetings, travel, also costs related to obtaining actuarial services, audit services, and accounting services. We found that administrative costs were high for the firefighter pension plan, but again, not totally unreasonable. In 2004, volunteer firefighter pension plans spent 0.42% of their assets on administration. Now, this is quite a bit more than what the state's large public employee pension plans pay, which is more in the area of 0.07% to 0.08% of assets. Yet we don't call it administrative expending by the firefighter plan. We don't think it's excessive. Most of the administrative spending, 53% of firefighter administrative spending, went to cover things such as audits, actuarial studies, and accounting services. 58% of the relief associations didn't pay anything at all to their board members, no board salaries. And in fact, almost a fifth of the associations did not report any administrative costs. In our view, the high administrative spending ratio, the 0.42%, it's largely due to relief associations not being able to take advantage of economies of scale. Okay, up to this point, we think things look pretty good. Good funding ratios, benefit levels that seem to make sense. When we come to the area of investments, we have some problems. We looked at the rates of return that volunteer firefighter relief associations earned over an 8-year period from 1997 through 2004. And we found that relief associations earned an average annual rate of return of 4.8%. And this ranged anywhere from a negative 2.7% up to a positive 13.7%. Now, we think the 4.8% is low compared with what other public employee pension plans made during that same time period and compared with what relief associations could have earned had they invested their funds a little differently. From 1997 through 2004, FBI's basic fund, which includes the funds for state employees, local government employees, and teachers, among others, that fund earned 8%. FBI's income share account, which is an account that relief associations can invest in if they want to, that fund earned 7.7%. We also compared the rate of return earned by the relief associations with a hypothetical composite that we refer to as a benchmark composite. And we developed this composite by based on the actual percentages of assets that relief associations invested in stocks, bonds, and cash instruments over the last several years. And then we said, well, what if you took the same amount of money and invested it in some common stock, bond, and cash indices? For example, what if you invested it in the Russell 3000 stock index and invested the same amount of money in the Lehman Brothers U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, some common indices? What would you have earned? Well, relief associations would have earned 6.3% on their pension funds if they would have invested in that way, in comparison with the 4.8% that they actually earned.
If I could just interrupt, we're actually over time already, so if we wanted to, could just kind of get to...
Bottom line is that we think they should be using the State Board of Investment to invest their funds. We think higher rates of return, lower investment costs, and that is our recommendation.
Okay. With that, Representative Shumper has a question.
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, Ms. Voss, I met with our Tri-County firefighters on January 7th, and they talked about this, and they have their concerns about it. But their biggest concern was this requirement for an annual audit if your assets are over $200,000, and they would like that raised to $400,000 or $500,000. Do you have an opinion on that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we felt that for the most part, because they are spending public monies, and this is a public function that they're performing, that having an audit was not unreasonable. And so we thought that that was a reasonable requirement.
Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, Ms. Voss, they also said they didn't think it was unreasonable. They just want the limit, the triggering limit, set higher at $400,000 or $500,000. Is that too high? Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mr. Noble.
Although, as Ms. Voss says, we think there should be an audit, and it will be up to you to decide what that threshold is. But we do think there is some streamlining of some of the reporting. Again, as we said at the very beginning, running 700 pension plans around the state by basically volunteers is a challenging situation. It's not easy. It's complicated. Making the investments, filling out the forms, They do send a lot of reports to the state auditor. This goes back to what I said earlier. The state auditor really has financial audit jurisdiction, doesn't do the audits, but CPA firms do the audits. Those audits are sent in to the state auditor, and then there's a lot of reporting requirements to the state auditor. And the state auditor actually compiles a report periodically about these pension plans. And we think, and you can, I know you're running out of time, but just look at our report, and you'll see that we have some recommendations for streamlining.
Representative Solberg.
That's okay. If you're, I'll...
Representative Lincheski.
Just a quick question, and I followed this a little bit for a while. We have a very, I think, the largest volunteer firefighter department in the state. And can you tell me, I was looking for, you know, is there somewhere we can actually see who's paying $500 after 20 years and who's paying $140,000? And I heard what you said, that it's not necessarily out of line depending on aid, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But is there any way that we can actually get that data as to what cities are doing what?
Ms. Boss.
Madam Chair, actually, the State Auditor's Office puts out a yearly report that includes, that lists all the individual departments.
Can you, just in general, characterize what are the low ones? Are they? I mean, just taking a guess, they're small rural areas, and what are the big ones? And
Ms. Vaughn.
Madam Chair, they're likely to be small rural ones without. The state aid is based on. State aid is based basically, paid out basically on property values and population. And so areas that get less state aid are going to tend to be right. More isolated, smaller, not well developed.
And the
big ones would be more around the cities, I would imagine. I can't recall off.
Madam Chair, we will go back and put a link on our website. I think many of you are familiar with it, so you don't have to search around. We'll link to the state auditors so that information that was requested earlier. I would just close with this because we know this is going to be controversial. We know that virtually no relief association supports that recommendation that they be required to invest their money through SBI. We understand that. We understand a lot of you will be opposed to that because it is an issue of local control. But I would point out to you that if they were investing through SBI, that they could have earned during this time frame that we were assessing from 1997 to 2004, they would be $56 million richer, and that money could have gone to better benefits, less city aid. So there is some impact here. I know this committee values local control. We respect that too. But we're talking about some pretty significant money here.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, and this meeting is adjourned.